What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everybody, it's Bruce, and it's such a beautiful day here in LA. And as always, I'm really glad you've pulled up a chair for Table for Two. Today, we're back at the Tower Bar for another great lunch.
I see the curtain moving. Da-na-na-na.
The 70s were a very specific time for me watching television, and it really influenced my love for California as a kid living in New York. I'm talking about stuff like Brady Bunch, Happy Days, and Three's Company. And as it turns out, our guest, Rita Wilson, was on all those shows.
Hi.
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 This will be fun.
She was born and raised in L.A. She's married to one of the biggest movie stars in the world, a guy named Tom Hanks. And she's an incredible actress, producer, and a singer with a new album of duets called Rita Wilson, Now and Forever. She also has some great stories about California in the 70s.
I ordered the loudest salad you could possibly order on the menu.
So, grab a rosé, because today we're having lunch with Rita Wilson. I'm Bruce Bozzi, and this is my podcast, Table for Two.
Welcome to Table for Two.
Thank you. Hi, Bruce.
For being here.
It's so nice to see you.
This is super exciting because the last time I saw you, we were at the Elton John concert at the Dodger Stadium.
Yes.
Sitting together, rocking out.
Yeah, that was so good. I saw him there, I guess it was the 70s.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that. The
70s. Yes, we'll talk all about the 70s. It's so extraordinary. I still feel this way, that we are living in a time where our heroes of our youth are still playing and still out there, and we can see them because so many people aren't doing what they used to do. But you have people like Elton, you have Paul McCartney, you have Bruce Springsteen, you have even Madonna now has been performing for like 40 years, you know. But that Chicago, the Eagles, those people are still out there performing.
100% Jimmy Buffett, all of them.
Yeah.
They're all in there.
Sometimes, I don't think it ever gets old because, you know, I grew up, I'm born and raised in Hollywood,
yeah,
as you know.
This is what I want you to talk to me about right now before we get to your album, which
Fine.
I love.
We'll do that too.
Right, so you grew up, I want to know about growing up in Hollywood, the 70s. You were on some of my favorite shows that got me to California, FYI. Happy Days, all of them. Happy Days, Three's Company. This is what I thought I was. I thought I was going to.
You're
going to
go live that life.
Go.
You're going to find some roommates.
Yes.
Well, I started to say that, talking about those people in music that are icons, you know, not just mine but the world's, is that I loved music so much that I got a job at Universal Studios. Used to have a venue called the Universal Amphitheater. And it's where the Harry Potter ride is now. Okay. But it used to be outdoors, and it was just bliss. And everybody came through there. So Elton came through there, Joni Mitchell, Carol King, Linda Ronstadt, the Eagles, Steve Martin would do comedy, you name it, they were there. And so I can't ever quite separate myself from the reverence that I have for all of those influences in music and what they felt like when I saw them the first time. Mm-hmm. And like my first concert was Led Zeppelin at the Forum, right?
Oh my God.
I just want to give your listeners a little visual of that too. Okay. So I went with two girlfriends of mine who were twins, and Rose and Carol O'Connell. Like, if they're out there listening, hi guys, I'd love to see you. And they were identical twins that were about 5'11" and shocks of red hair and freckles and just, you know, fantastic physiques. Right. And just, they looked like gazelles.
Right.
And my mom used to make my clothes. So she made me an outfit that was a Hawaiian print fabric with a turquoise background and like canoes and surfboards and palm trees and, you know, those kind of flowers on it. Yellows, reds, pinks.
Right.
And the pants were drawstring bell bottoms.
Okay.
And then full midriff exposed.
Okay.
And then the top was like a little short sleeve thing, but you would tie the top like right under your boobs.
Right.
So that was my outfit.
Totally can picture it.
Okay.
Right.
With these things called wedgies were my sandals. I'm sorry, corkies were my sandals.
Corkies,
those are
like a cork, big heel.
Big platform.
Right. Oh, yes.
Right.
Big.
So we were so excited running to the Forum to see Led Zeppelin that I fell flat on my face running with my corkies. And you suffer from beauty. You suffer for beauty.
You do. You really
got right back up and kept running.
Okay, you didn't smash anything?
No.
Those, don't you think those days and having those, like, that's, it's the best to have. And you grew up at a time, and like you referenced that in the 70s, because you also grew up in Los Angeles. To me, the sweet magic spot of Los Angeles was the 60s and the 70s. I don't care what anyone says. And we also know what was happening in music in the 70s in Los Angeles with Joni Mitchell, with Mama Cass, with
and Carole King and Stevie Nicks.
So talk to me about like what were you running around in like that music scene? Like you with
Okay, let's just take Laurel Canyon for example. Laurel Canyon, for many people, was a literal place, but also a metaphorical place. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was the same thing. I knew that Carole King and Joni Mitchell and all these people that I loved were living up there. I have two stories about Laurel Canyon that are particular. Would you like to hear them?
Yes.
Okay. One is that in high school, Bobby Carradine, who was David Carradine's brother, and he was an actor also, went to my high school. He was a little bit older than I was, I think. And he asked me out on a date, and he had a little Alfa Romeo, like a red sports car. So he said, let's go for a ride, you know, just drive around. And I think it was a school night, so it was pretty early.
Right.
But we were driving around, and he says, well, let's go up and visit my brother. Now, his brother at the time was David Carradine, and he was doing the series Kung Fu.
Right.
Remember that?
Yes, I do.
So I said, sure. At that time, I had eaten at home, and he takes us up, and David was married to Barbara Hershey, who at that time was going by the name Barbara Hershey Siegel. Because Siegel, like Siegel.
Oh, right. She was a hippie.
Exactly.
Right.
So they were like, okay, let's go see what my brother's doing. So we show up. And they had a little baby, and the baby wasn't even walking. It was just a crawling baby, but it was Laurel Canyon.
Right.
They were hippies.
Mm-hmm.
It was not, they had a big, huge dog. It was not the cleanest of kitchens, let's say, but the baby was on the floor. And I took one look around, and I was like, oh, I'm not really, like, vibing with this whole, you know, like, not really clean vibe.
So, it's a little too hippie.
Yeah, but the baby is there and so cute, and she's making some kind of dinner, and, you know, we all sit down to eat, and they asked me if I wanted to eat, and I said no, because I had just eaten at my parents', right? So I said, thank you very much. And they, would you like something to drink? And I said, yes.
Right.
What could they do to get something to drink?
Right.
So she passes over a communal bowl of water.
Oh, this is Amazing.
And so I did one of those fake things where you like pretend you're sipping, but you're really just like your lips are closed. Like, you know, now during COVID, that wouldn't fly.
Right, not at all.
So that was one Laurel Canyon story.
Which really epitomizes what was Laurel Canyon.
Yes, it really did.
A communal bowl of water.
It was, but the thing was that people really believed it. They believed in this idea of free love and taking care of each other, and everybody shares everything. Yeah. And so there was something to it that really was authentic. It wasn't fake.
Right.
I mean, they were in a private in their moment and at home, and that's how they were living.
Right, right.
So, no judgment.
No judgment.
Just my own issues with germs.
I kind of have the same issues. Okay, fine. I would have been like, I could tell you stories. Yeah.
The other Laurel Canyon story that's so great is, so this is so fun. Nobody's ever asked me this stuff before.
Really?
So,
really?
Like, or talk about these stories, right? So, two of my best friends growing up were Catholic, and they went to a Catholic girls' school called Corvallis. It was on Laurel Canyon, just south of Ventura Boulevard. The building is still there, but it's not a girls' school anymore.
Right.
And one of their best friends there was Melanie Griffith. So I met Melanie when I was like 16 or 17 years old, right? And Melanie was dating Don Johnson at that time already.
Mm-hmm.
And Don had a house in Laurel Canyon. Cher also had a house up the street from them, and she had a turquoise blue Dino Ferrari. And I've never asked her this, but I will one day.
So happy right
was
now.
Was that true? Did you have a turquoise blue Dino Ferrari?
Right.
I believe that Cher would have had that.
I think she would have, 100%.
So Melanie and Don were seeing each other, and we were over there one day, and it was cold. It was Dawn's house, but
right.
Melanie was still in high school, but it was also kind of random because she was still dating Dawn. So I don't know if she lived at home or she lived with Dawn at that
very
time.
It was very free love.
Very free love.
Yeah.
So Melanie says to Dawn, Donnie, it's cold. Can you light a fire? And he says, yeah, sure. So we girls are outside, we're doing something, we're laughing, whatever. We hear some noise, we don't think much of it. We come back in and there's a gorgeous fire roaring
right.
in this Laurel Canyon cottage. And Melanie says, where'd you get the firewood? He says, I chopped up one of the chairs. Which he did. He chopped up one of the dining room chairs.
What was happening?
I don't know. So Melanie says one night, we want to fix you up with somebody. I said, okay, who? She said, he's really nice. Desi Arnaz Jr. I'm like, oh, yeah, he's kind of cute. Yeah, that'd be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's do it.
Uh-huh.
So I was driving my parents' Barracuda, because as one does.
Right.
And I go pick up Melanie at Tippi's house.
Right. So Tippi Hendren is Melanie's mother. She was a big star for all of you who might
all
not
the Hitchcock
know.
Movies.
Yeah, yeah.
She did The Birds. She did so many Hitchcock films. Marnie, I think she was in that too.
Yeah.
And I go pick up Melanie, and she says, you know, like, I'll be right there. Somebody lets me into the house. And in the backyard, and I'm not kidding you, is a Black Panther. Because Tippi was an animal activist.
Mm-hmm.
And she kept this Black Panther or Puma or whatever it is. It was all black.
Right.
Yeah. Big.
Probably a panther, I think. Yeah.
All in the backyard. And I'm looking through the sliding glass. I'm like, I'm not going out there.
Right.
Not going out there. So we go. Melanie comes down. We go. We go to Desi's house to pick him up. And that's where Dawn is.
Right.
So, and the four of us go in one car to a restaurant.
How old is Desi at this point? Are we talking early 20s?
I mean, probably, I was 17. 19,
20, so, 22.
Yeah, probably 20. Right, I don't know, young.
Right.
So, no, he couldn't have been that young because this is part of the story. We go to this restaurant in Century City that was very popular at the time called Yamato's.
Okay.
It was in the, what is now the Fairmont, okay. St. Regis, mm-hmm. I guess is that what it's called? But it used to be the Century Plaza Hotel.
Right.
So it was a Japanese restaurant, and it was the kind of restaurant where it had the soji screens mm-hmm. so that you could have private rooms, and then they would have these soji screens that would close off the little rooms. And there was a sunken seating with tatami mats, so everybody sat on the floor, and it was very lovely. And we go in, and the maitre d' meets us at the restaurant, and he says, "Mr. Arness, so nice to see you. Miss Minnelli has just arrived." Now, he dated Liza Minnelli, and they had just broken up.
Oh. So if you could see me his face, like you're telling the story with the maitre d' kind of giving the nonverbal, "We have a problem here."
Who's like,
"Mr. Arness,
what would you like me to do?"
Right, right.
So they put us in one of those private rooms with the soji screens.
Okay.
It was a big thing that they had broken up, right?
Right.
Big thing. So we go into this room. We order food. And every time the waitress comes in, and she's in a kimono with an obi and the whole thing, she leaves the door open because she's coming back and forth. And every time that door was open, Desi would get up and close that door because he was so afraid Liza was going to walk by or something. So there was no second date because obviously,
there was no
chemistry.
There was no liftoff.
Exactly,
I mean, it was like drama from sitting down. For the time you grew up here, everyone was sort of accessible.
Lucy Arnaz told me that she and Desi, because Lucy lived right in the flats of Beverly Hills, on Roxbury and Lexington, and she said that they would go outside and they'd have lemonade stands and they would, you know, sell cookies. And they were the kids of famous people.
Yeah, Jimmy Stewart lived down the block.
Right across the street.
Right
across the street from them.
It just had that vibe.
No, she said that Desi would get in the car and give people tours. "Oh, here's, let me show you." Strangers. People pull up. "That's Lucy's house." "Oh, I'll show you where everybody else lives." And you get in the car with them.
I'm telling you, that's the magic of L.A. in the 70s, where I was a New York kid watching this on TV going, "Wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go there." So now you did shows like Three's Company, MASH, Brady Bunch, Happy Days, Who's the Boss, Bosom Buddies. Those are the ones I read. I mean, all classics. Come on. Was it not just fun?
It was so much fun. It was amazing.
What was, like, the best? Like,
well, you know, I loved auditioning because you would go to a studio, you'd go to an office, and all these photographs would be on the wall of all the shows that you loved. Like, the people that produced The Brady Bunch also produced Gilligan's Island.
Right.
So you loved that.
Right.
When I did my episode of The Brady Bunch, Pat Conway, for those of you who want to look it up, the episode.
I do.
It's when Greg had to choose between his sister and his girlfriend for cheerleader.
Oh.
And he was the deciding vote and chose Pat Conway,
played
by yours truly. But the day that I was filming, the director, Dick Michaels, he was dating Elizabeth Montgomery, who played Samantha in Bewitched.
Right.
So she came by the set. So I got to see her, too. Still to this day, if I go into a soundstage, that smell of it's so specific, it puts me right back like you could be in the 70s.
Welcome back to Table for Two. Rita has had a very successful career in television, movies, and as a producer, but she has another passion, music. A few years ago, she decided to follow her dreams, and I want to know what inspired her latest album of duets.
So Rita, you have an album out called Rita Wilson, Now and Forever. So I've been...
Duets.
No, it's duets. It's duets because, yes, it's important because I want to ask you about the people you sing with, because you sing with, like, really cool people. But you also picked really great songs of that time. So what made you choose these songs? And then I would like to kind of go through and, like, I just want to share who you're singing. Like, I mean, these are all songs I loved growing up with. So we have a very similar vibe in music.
Fantastic music
just
in the 70s.
Just FYI. So for the people, like, Where Is the Love? You sing with Smokey Robinson.
Because mm-hmm.
you chose these artists to perform with, like, what was, like, maybe a word or something about, like, Keith Urban or Willie Nelson, like, all these Jackson Browne, like,
mm-hmm.
this is epic. Everyone needs to download this album. Go, read it.
Thank you. Well, I love the 70s. My very first album was cover songs from the 60s and 70s. That album was called AM/FM.
Mm-hmm.
And when I had done a number of albums in between of original music that I wrote, because I started going down to Nashville and writing with a bunch of people down there. And I thought, maybe it's time to revisit some cover songs again. And I started thinking, what would be fun to do? And this idea of doing duets, but of songs that haven't been done as duets, started to really formulate, right? Mm-hmm. Only Where Is the Love had been a duet in the 70s with Roberta Flack and Donny Hathaway. So my co-producer, Matt Rawlings, and I, he's an amazing producer. He's won Grammys for Willie Nelson's Gershwin album and the Sinatra album. I was like, he knows what I'm trying to go for.
Mm-hmm.
So we started talking, and we started with a huge grab bag of music, just all different kinds of songs. We love this. We love that. Let's put this in. Let's put that in. And then we started going through them and saying, okay, which ones would actually be like what I was hoping, conversations between two people.
Right.
Oh. So then that started coming up with, it started narrowing it down even further. And so really, when I would present songs to artists that I was looking to work with, I would usually give them three songs and see which one they responded to the most. And they usually picked the one that I would have wanted them to pick. Isn't so that worked out great.
Right.
And it was just incredible to work with these people that I've so admired, like Willie Nelson also on the album, who we did Slip Sliding Away, mm-hmm. Paul Simon's song.
Yeah.
And that conversation, that song in terms of a conversation, took on a completely different vibe when you think, oh, this is a couple that's been together a really long time and they're talking to each other mm-hmm. about the other.
Right.
And I just loved interpreting it in a new way of looking at it.
I love that you're sharing it like that, because it does put a whole new sort of art to the listening of you singing with them, because a song that wasn't meant to be a duet but then is sung between.
Mm-hmm.
So just so everyone gets an idea, so this Crazy Love with Keith Urban, super good. There's Where Is the Love with Smokey Robinson. There's Slip Sliding Away with Willie Nelson. There's Let It Be Me with Jackson Browne. I mean, are we getting it here? There's Massachusetts with Leslie Odom Jr. I mean, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
I'll Be There with Jimmy Allen. Without You, Vince Gill. I read this to Brian last night. He was like, oh my God, Songbird with Josh Groban. How did you choose that list? Were these men that all you just had a connection with? You were like, you know, I want to work with.
I did not know Willie, but Matt did, because he had worked with him on the two previous albums. And Willie was the first person to sign on, which was fantastic. God, and you know, if somebody like Willie signs on,
right.
then it makes the next ask very...
right. Right.
Not very easy, but a lot easier. You know,
right.
like, oh, okay. We're talking that kind of an album. All right,
right,
fine.
Right.
So we just reached out to people. We were kind of lucky because it was during the second year of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So still people weren't really touring. They
right.
weren't out. So people were home and willing to be creative. And we're like, okay, yeah, we'll do it.
What a beautiful album. And, you know, one of the things that I love about learning about you and learning about the music side of you, when you wanted to express yourself artistically through your voice and your music, and you thought maybe that chapter had passed, because we all feel like as we get older, oh, you know, and you, I know you spoke with Bruce Springsteen, who was like,
mm-hmm.
hey, no, because that takes courage.
It was so empowering, illuminating, exciting to hear this from Bruce Springsteen, who I asked once when he was talking a lot about songwriting, And I was just enraptured by it. And there was a pause in the conversation. And I said, all right. I had just started writing music. And he said, I asked him this, what makes me think that I can start writing now? And you've been doing it all your life. I'm getting a really late start. And he said, because Reitz, creativity is time independent. And that, hearing that, it just felt so true to me. And I had never heard anybody put it to me like that.
Yeah.
I'd never heard that concept, but it got me thinking that, yeah, who's to say that you're only allowed to be creative and be valued for that when you're in your 20s,
right,
or you're in your early 30s or whatever. Who says that there's a clock on creativity and that, oh, sorry, your time has passed,
right,
and the clock has run out on you?
I loved hearing that.
Oh, it's just because I believe, Bruce, so many people are creative.
Yep.
And I'm reading that Rick Rubin book right now, The Creative Act, A Way of Being or A Way of Living. And people, I think, when they're younger, they get different messages about what it means to be creative.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get the message that you have no talent, or you can get the message that is, you can't make a living being an artist. That's
right.
No, you can't do that.
Right.
Or you have two left feet. You can't be a dancer, or whatever it is. I've during my touring, when I signed, you know, CDs and things for people, I would hear all sorts of stories like that.
Yeah.
And that creative impulse gets shut down. One of the things that Rick Rubin said in his book, which I believe is very accurate, is that everybody's life is a creative act. Every morning we get up and we can create the day that we want to create.
Yeah.
How we look at that day, how we respond to that day, what we do for ourselves during that day or for others. And I love that philosophy that everybody does have a creative impulse. But for some reason, society doesn't really support that in a way. They support other ideas of, like, you got to make a living, you got to get an education,
yeah,
you got to,
no,
whatever.
You're right. They don't support it. And those early years specifically, when people say you can, the people that are sort of shaping you,
mm-hmm,
either lean in,
right,
or lean out. And we do. We live in a culture that sort of values, this is when you can do this, or youth is when you can do this. But, you know, as we get older, and it's, you know, you're talking.
Did you ever have anything that you wanted to do as a kid? Like, when you look back on your childhood, what did you love to do and what gave you the most joy?
Yes. So I would say, looking back, and this is so specific to the time that we grew up because we're peers,
mm-hmm,
is, as I put chicken in my mouth, really, I'm nervous from this question. I'm like, wait, I'm going to shove my mouth with food.
What was it, though?
It was dancing. I would love to have been pursued and been in a ballet class. But boys were not, that
correct,
was not happening. That
correct
was tap dance. My sister, I went to her recitals.
Right.
You know, but that was not, so, okay. And then,
you could take a dance class now.
I know.
You
I
really
keep
should.
That. Like, why can't I?
You should do it.
You know, I should do it. I asked John Bon Jovi, who sat with me and at lunch, and I said, you know, what did Rockstar mean to him?
And not the ones that are already established rock stars as we know them. You're
right,
talking about the up-and-coming,
right,
rock stars?
I was like, is there a rock star today? So I can tell you who he said.
Who did he say?
He said Harry Styles. That to him was,
mm-hmm,
you know, he kind of embodies what,
mm-hmm,
he felt as a rock star today.
I think Miley Cyrus is a rock star.
Yeah.
Because she can sing anything.
Mm-hmm.
She can move. She's so uninhibited. She's so free. I can endlessly watch her.
Yeah, she is. You can't take your eyes off her.
Mm-hmm.
You're right.
And I look at rock stars a very different thing than somebody like Beyonce or Adele, who are full-on stars.
Right.
We know that. But a rock star is somebody who's got that bit,
right,
of an edge, right?
Right.
In a weird way, even though this is not her genre, but I think Cardi B, in an odd way, is a rock star because
right,
she's such a rebel.
Yeah.
Just do whatever she wants to
really
do.
Is.
So there's something about inhabiting that rebel.
Right. It's presentation. It's,
yes,
charisma. It's,
yes,
like, it's why when we looked at Jagger that night, we were like, oh.
Yeah, we're like,
I mean, come on. Here's this guy that just came in and...
I always look at their shoes. Like, what kind of shoes are they wearing? He was wearing, like, little black tennis shoes.
He was. I love that they're things. That's a good question.
Like, I'm like, what does a rock star wear in real life? He's wearing black
Now, would there be shoes that you'd be like, ooh, I'm surprised? Like...
Like, if there was a sock with a Birkenstock, right, that might give me pause.
I mean, you taught me a word, Freudenfreud.
Oh, I love that word.
I learned from you. Tell everyone what Freudenfreud is.
Well, you know, everybody knows the word Schadenfreude. Mm-hmm. That is sort of getting pleasure out of somebody's... failure, but I read that there is actually another word called Freudenfreude, which is being happy for someone's success. And I always approached everything that I did that way.
Yeah.
Even when I started, you know, first started acting and first started auditioning, and people would say, don't ever tell anybody about your auditions. Right. Why? Why? Well, because they might take the part. And I was like, that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm so different from that person or that person. If they want me, they'll hire me.
Right.
And if they want her, they're going to hire her.
Yeah.
So I never felt that somebody else's success diminished my own or made it less available to me.
Right.
So I loved, I can't believe everybody talks about Schadenfreude, but nobody talks about Freudenfreude.
Thanks for joining us on Table for Two. Though Rita has been in many movies, there's a wonderful filmmaker in particular that she really bonded with, the incredible Nora Ephron.
You know, there's a woman that I think was an important person in your life who I was blessed to know, Nora Ephron. Nora clearly loved you, and she clearly knew how to write for you. Can you tell me about that relationship and the movies you made with her, and just tell us all about it?
Well, all my life, I really longed for a mentor, someone who could say, for example, if I had that person in music, maybe I would have started music at a much younger age. But I didn't have anybody who said, oh, you love singing, you love performing. Oh, you know, you can do XYZ, or there's singing classes, or you can go to this community theater and get in a musical, or something. I didn't have anybody who directed me. My parents were immigrants, so they weren't really up with, you know, what kids were doing in those days.
Sure.
So I met Nora because Tom was doing Bonfire of the Vanities. It was 1987, and we rented an apartment in the building in New York, the Apthorpe, where Nora and Nick lived. And Max, her son, and Jacob were still little, so they were living there, right? The windows would be open, and I would hear, like, this guitar playing going on, you know, every day. Guitar playing, guitar playing, guitar playing. Well, it turns out it was Max Bernstein, Nora's son. And he now is Taylor Swift's lead guitarist. Okay, so just saying. He did okay with those lessons.
It worked out.
Right. But I didn't really become friendly with Nora until, people probably don't know this, but Tom was offered When Harry Met Sally. And he turned it down because he was going through a divorce and he was very happy to be not married. And so he could not understand that a person going through a divorce would have anything other than just like, I'm so happy. But I loved that script. So I read that script when it came in and I just flipped out and I was like, God, this woman, Nora Ephron, she did that movie we really liked, This Is My Life, with Julie Kavner.
Right.
It was about a stand-up comedian at the age of 50.
Yes.
Remind me to go back to the age of 50 and Nora.
Okay.
So I wrote Rob because I had worked with Rob and I was like, this script is so fantastic. I can't, Rob Reiner, the director.
Yeah.
I said, this is just mind-boggling. So cut to a few years later, Tom is offered Sleepless in Seattle. And I loved that script so much, and it was Nora. And I ran into her at a party at Linda Obst's house.
Okay.
Now, Carrie Fisher.
Mm-hmm. It's all very good.
I know. It's all familial. Yeah. Carrie Fisher was in This Is My Life, and she was in When Harry Met Sally.
Yes.
And I just loved how Nora wrote for her.
Right.
So I ran into her at the party, and I said, Nora, if you're not going to cast Carrie in the role of the best friend, which was the Rosie O'Donnell part,
right. Mm-hmm.
I would love to audition for it. She calls me in for an audition. I was like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. Mm-hmm. So I go in an audition, and I didn't get the part. They gave it to Rosie.
Right.
But Nora offered me the role of Susie, this other character. And I was like, oh yeah, that was a really good part of the script. I really liked that character. There's a big monologue in there.
Right.
So I ended up doing that monologue from about the movie An Affair to Remember. And that ended up being one of the most fun, most wonderful acting experiences I've ever had. Then soon after that, she offered me a part in a movie called Mixed Nuts, mm-hmm. with Steve Martin, yeah. and Madeleine Kahn and Richard Kine and Gary Shanley. John Stewart is in it. Parker Posey is in it. Adam Sandler. Juliette Lewis. It was an incredible cast.
Wow.
Yeah. Liev Schreiber's first role.
Okay.
So then we did that movie. And, you know, sadly, it wasn't successful when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's become this weird cult favorite.
Of course, because right.
It's like, so, it's a weird movie, but it's a really good weird movie.
Yeah.
Let me go back to the 50s.
Yeah. So Nora.
So,
50, right.
On my 50th birthday, because Nora actually became like one of my best friends.
Right.
And she said on my 50th birthday, as she was toasting with a glass of champagne, because she loved champagne, here's to turning 50. Great things can happen to you after you turn 50. I didn't direct my first movie until I was 50.
Mm.
She died at 71. Look what she did in that 21 yep. years.
Wow. It's really important to hear that.
Yes.
To hear you tell, it's just really receive that.
Because there was no clock on creativity for
right.
her.
Right.
She was a journalist, don't forget.
Yeah.
She was a hardcore journalist.
Yep.
And then she decided she was going to write scripts. She wrote Silkwood, for crying
yeah.
out loud.
Right.
A very serious movie.
Yeah.
I had an interesting conversation with a friend of mine. He's a Hindu priest. And we were talking about purpose. I asked him, well, wait a minute, how do you know what your purpose is? Like, you can, because, you know, we were having conversations. I want to do this. I want to do that. He goes, you know, purpose is very simple. You ask yourself this question. What is it that I can still do on my deathbed that will be my purpose, that has nothing to do with engaging, you know, I need three people to do it, or I have to have a certain, you know, environment to do it. And when he said that, I knew exactly what my purpose was. And it was, it sounds so simple, but to bring joy.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be able to put stuff like that out into the world. You know, that's where my head is at. That's where I find the most satisfaction out of
right.
doing stuff like that.
Well, I love that you said that, because when I was thinking about you, joy was the word that came up. And I feel
that is so nice, though.
No, but it's the intention. You know, I do want to know about what it felt like to be, because I think it's so great, to your experience when you are playing Roxy in Chicago. Like, was that a good experience to be on Broadway? Was that a dream? Was that like...
Oh, my God. This was a Nora moment also.
Really?
Yes. Because I got offered to do Chicago. And Nora said, well, you know, you should go into town and see the show and make sure it's in good shape. And what she meant was, you know, is it still good?
Right.
You know, is it fallen apart?
Mm-hmm.
It's been on for so long. How good could it still be?
Right.
So I go into town with Tom and my daughter, Elizabeth, to see the show. And at the, it's fantastic. It's so good. Right. And at the intermission, I turned to Tom and Elizabeth and I'm like, there's no way I'm doing this.
Because?
Terrifying.
Terrifying.
Terrifying. I said, there's no way I'm doing this or that I can do this. Right. And they looked at me like I was nuts. Like, what? Are you kidding? You are so doing this? Yep. And I'm like, no, nope, I am not. No, you're doing it. Yep. And I was terrified. But it brought me, talk about connecting dots. Honestly, this is why we have to be brave and do things that are out of our comfort zone. My dance captain, Greg Butler, who is still a friend today, he taught me so much about courage. He taught me so much about patience, about what we do to ourselves in our heads that have nothing to do with what we actually can be doing in real life, in real time. And he was very funny. But after the play was finished, he introduced me to the woman who changed my life because she was the one who said, offered me the idea that I could be a songwriter. And her name is Kara DioGuardi. And she was a songwriter, and she had done Chicago because she was a judge on American Idol, and she's fantastic, right? As a, but she was badass, went to Duke. She was a songwriter, had hit songs, was way more than what she just was as a judge on Idol. But she ended up doing Roxy. And Greg said to me, you need to meet Kara DioGuardi. I think you guys are going to hit it off. So after she did the play, I can't remember how long, he introduced us. Mm-hmm. We met. And in that meeting, the first meeting, she said to me, well, so what do you want to do? I said, I don't know. I probably would give anything if I could write a song like you, but I can't. She goes, why can't you? Mm. I was like, well, because I don't write music. I don't read music. I'm not a musician. You know, I play an instrument. I don't do anything. She goes, neither do I. Do you have something you want to say? Yeah. And when she said that, mm-hmm. I was like, I got a butterflies in my stomach and kind of like that pit. And I'm like, yeah, I totally have something I want to say. She goes, I want to write your songs with you, first two songs. Wow. And she did. And that opened the door to songwriting. Right. And if I had not done Chicago,
yeah,
I would not have met Kara. Nope. I would not have become a songwriter. And I would not be here sitting here talking to you about my new album.
As we finish our lunch, I am thinking of all the great things Rita has done in her career and the courage she found to start a new chapter in music. And what comes to my mind is the theme song that used to end the Carol Burnett Show in the 1970s. And it was, I'm so glad we had this time together just to have a laugh or sing a song. And today, I don't know about you, but I've had many laughs and we've actually sang songs. So let's check in one more time with the incredible Rita Wilson.
I think being a woman, at least in the generation that I grew up in, it was very easy to be visibly invisible. And because I was taught, you know, don't make waves. Right. You're here to please people, make everybody feel good, make everybody, you know, not feel threatened. So I think that it takes, at least for me, it took a really long time to sort of, I like to say, find my voice.
Yeah.
And I mean that literally and metaphorically. Yep. And I do believe, like I said earlier, that people know who they are at a very young age, but it gets sort of buried.
Yep.
If you don't have the right circumstances. You know, I still feel that way sometimes, right. You know.
Yeah.
I still feel that way.
Doesn't go away fully.
No. And it's so ingrained in your upbringing and everything.
Yeah.
But I try to be aware of it and try not to let it get out of the way, you know, like too far out of the way.
You have to catch it.
Yeah, catch it.
You know, you catch it, and I think you said, and I say the same thing, it's finding your voice. And I think what Nora said, this also coming back, I think our conversation sort of, as we end, it's like at 50 we found out life begins. When do you find,
yes,
your voice? When, who do you know who, yes, you are? And it becomes with age and wisdom. And I just want to thank you.
Thank you
for coming here and having lunch. I want everyone to download Rita Wilson, Now and Forever, Duets, because it really, it's just a beautiful album.
Thank you so much.
You're a beautiful person. It's joy. I hope everyone who pulled up a chair, go have a great day.
I wish everyone could have lunch with you, because you have the best questions. It was effortless and so much fun.
Thank you.
You are gifted at this.
Thank you.
Now the only thing we need to add is a couple of dance lessons.
Okay, let's do that. There you go. Okay, everyone, have a great day.
Table for Two with Bruce Bozzi is produced by iHeartRadio, 737 Park, and Airmail. Our executive producers are Bruce Bozzi and Nathan King. Table for Two is researched and written by Bridget Arsenault. Our sound engineers are Paul Bowman and Alyssa Midgaff. Table for Two's LA production team is Danielle Romo and Lorraine Virez. Our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our talent booking is by Jane Sarkin. Special thanks to Amy Sugarman, Uni Scher, Kevin Uvain, Bobby Bauer, Allison Cantor-Graber, Barbara and Jen, and Jeff Klein and the staff at the Tower Bar in the world-famous Sunset Tower Hotel. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.